In this scenario, Bob, there are a lot of different aspects that we could home in on. Automation, airborne weather, cockpit making decisions, how to deal with an emergency. Let's start with that thing where, right where you started, with the autopilot itself. This pilot is in moderate to severe turbulence, and you're going to turn around. You're suggesting using the autopilot for the maneuver. So you're kind of putting it out there. This plane is now in a bank, and you've already said this autopilot may not be the best at doing this. Why even expose yourself to the risk and not just hand fly right off the bat?
Well, Jeff, I'd give it a try. I'd see how the autopilot acts. I could always disconnect and hand fly the airplane. But to the extent it can handle it, it's going to be a big help, at least in controlling the bank angle and allowing us to get to the desired heading a little bit more easily than we would if we had to now, in addition, hand fly that heading.
I'm curious if anybody else around the table would have kept using the autopilot or if other people would have just disconnected and just focused on the hand flying for the turn.
Well, a lot of autopilots will disconnect in this kind of turbulence. So you may not have that choice even.
But I think I would have given it a shot anyhow and just rotate the heading bug around. Even if the autopilot disconnected, you'd still have the flight director showing you your bank angle and showing you which way to turn and at least another pitch reference that way too. So worth a shot anyhow. The worst that happens is, you know, as you said, it disconnects.
But you have to be careful because it might disconnect and it may take you a while to notice that. That disconnect chime going might not be get your full attention in this situation.
with the thunder cracking all around you.
Yeah. Right, if you could even hear it.
And you're
all
expecting the autopilot to help you and it may have disconnected. You may not have noticed until you're in a really steep bank.
Which is why keeping the flight director up might help.
Right, and that's kind of where my point was. If you're asking this to autopilot to make a bank and then you potentially could have it disconnect and you're already in a rolling motion in somewhat severe turbulence. So being able to pick that up and know what the autopilot's doing, boy, I don't know. That's a you're
kind of the
focusing on the autopilot instead of the attitude.
It's kind of the least worst. You're in a bad situation here, so.
Yeah, I feel like there's sort of a lot of unknowns and untried things with the autopilot here. I don't know how aggressively it's going to respond to changes in attitude and things like that. So I think my reaction would probably be to kill the autopilot right away, hand fly it, really shallow bank, and it might not take more than 90 degrees to the right based on the fact that we just kind of turned 90 degrees into the storm, maybe another 90 and then straight ahead for a while, get us out quicker.
I think for me, I would disengage the autopilot entirely if I were in that situation. And I think I would do that because from a mental bandwidth standpoint, I don't think I would want the autopilot flying part of it while I'm doing other parts of it. And I think that if I were hand flying the entire thing, maintaining that airspeed and getting myself turned around, I think I would find that easier to do if I were doing all of it hand flying and the autopilot not doing any of it.
I agree completely with both you, Kevin, and Ryan. I'd disconnect. My focus now is going to be on getting turned around. I don't have to worry about relying on the autopilot, and I might be now thinking about several other things at once. Right now, if you've made that decision to turn, now you really have to focus on doing it. And I think the best way is to disconnect, focus on getting the turn done.
Let's go tech geek here for a moment before we look at other things. If it was an attitude-based, AHARS-based digital autopilot built into the aircraft, you know, it was a G1000 airplane or it was a G5 driving a new Garmin autopilot, would you use it then? Change it for anybody or is it like, no? I'm curious.
I still think your first priority right now is making that turn or maintaining the aircraft attitude. And as others have noted, just focus on that. That's your immediate priority for the next couple of minutes. Everything else goes out the window. You don't care about your altitude. You don't care about exact all the other details. You just want to keep the airplane under control. So I don't care what kind of autopilot. I'm going to hand fly and maybe use the flight director to help me.
I think the main takeaway here, right, is get up and get in a bunch of thunderstorms. Try it different ways.
Can I come with you, Ryan?
Everybody agrees with that,
can I send
right?
a camera with you? I can retrieve it later. I'll put a little parachute on it.
Well, I'd like to just point out that this airplane is not foreign to this pilot. He's flown with this autopilot before and undoubtedly has flown in some sort of turbulence in clear air. And he should have an understanding of how well that aircraft reacts based on the STEG 55X in terms of the roll and so forth, and how well it can control a bank angle.
But let me ask, is there anyone at this table who has not at least once in their flying hours said, why is the autopilot doing that? And this is not the time to be trying to figure that out, no matter how well you know the autopilot.
Well, that we've got basic consensus on, or actually maybe two camps on the autopilot use. Let's go to the turnaround, which is the other half of this. It's still there in the ACs that, man, you're in a cell, keep the wings level as best you can, hold your attitude, and just fly through it. Anyone going straight, or is everyone turning around?
Well, the AC is not the pilot in command here, okay? The pilot needs to exercise good judgment and based on the facts at hand. And I think in this case, as I said in the expert response, there's a better shot turning around and attempting to remain clear of what looks like certainly worse weather up ahead.
And that AC was written before most of us had in-cockpit weather information available to us.
That's a good point.
And
Bruce.
So every situation obviously is dynamic and you don't know exactly what's going on, but you do have a little bit more information here than I think the AC was predicated on. And so in this particular situation, it's a real judgment call.
I think Ryan brought up an interesting point too about which way to turn. You know, you said you turned 90 degrees to get into it, turn another 90 to get out. Because looking at this, my initial thing was to turn left. And I think most of the time pilots were kind of, you know, we make left traffic all the time. We do a lot of left turns. My initial thing was to turn left without thinking about really which way to go. And it's just, you know, you probably don't have a lot of time to look at the display here and everything. Is it just keep the turn going or to reverse it or...
Yeah, I was just thinking get back or close to somewhere where you just were where you weren't in it. But, of course, that's no guarantee either if everything's building. But maybe that's the best bet.
What if there wasn't the kind of information you had? Either, you know, you were traveling through what you thought was relatively clear air. You're cruising along. You didn't have this big cell that you were trying to avoid. And you start thumping like this. It can happen. Like, you know, you flew right into it. Do you turn around then or do you go straight? How do you handle just sort of a surprise encounter? Would you all turn around?
By turn around, you mean 180.
180.
Or like, would you just take 30 or 40 or something to aim for the greener spot?
Yeah, or maybe, you know, if it's building, especially, you may not be even seeing the next red return that's accurate for what's going on right now. You flew into it thinking it looked fairly benign.
It's real-time activity that's showing yet on the next graph.
Right.
Yes.
So you don't have that piece of information. Do you fall back on the AC of, well, you know, this is getting bumpy, but I'm just going to fly through? Or every time this is surprise, turbulence, and this is getting worse, I'm turning around? How do you mull that out in real time?
I don't think you can have any one answer. Because of the latency issue that you're talking about with data link weather, I don't think there's any one-size-fits-all answer that you could possibly have for this kind of a situation. You need to use situational awareness and use the best judgment for the situation you're in at that moment.
Boy, you're right on, Kevin. I agree with that. Yeah.
But speaking of the technology now and latency of data link, Bob, you made a comment, at least the way I heard it, that you would rather use the data link lightning strikes as opposed to the storm scope. I've got to say that I would completely disagree with you 180 degrees because storm scope is real time. And admittedly, there can be errors and things that can fool you, but it is real time. I remember years ago when we didn't have NexRad radar in the cockpits, but I was flying a Malibu Mirage with a storm scope and Miami wanted to turn me right into a cell. And I said, can't do, unable, and why not? And I said, well, because I'm seeing a bunch of strikes. And we also have to have a discussion here of those strikes that we see and what types of strikes ADS-B or NexRad or StormScope give. StormScope gives everything, whether it's intercloud, intracloud, or cloud-to-ground. And they're different stages. They represent different stages of a thunderstorm. In my situation, the storm was building, and it was intercloud lightning that was going on. Miami said, well, we don't see anything because no precip had started.
The other thing I'll build on with that is you need to think about what lightning strikes air traffic control is looking at on their scope, and they aren't looking at any.
So exactly.
Given that air traffic control, all they can see is precipitation intensity. So the lack of that sort of information on the controller scope can lead them to not have the same mental image that you do of the weather situation as it exists around you.
And that was exactly the situation I was referring to in Florida. And then it was less than a minute later, the storm went mature. Miami said, oh.
And depending upon whether you're talking to center or an approach, there's different radar systems too. Tracons are using real radar live updates, and centers using warp, which is basically NEXRAD with the built-in delays. So it's something to keep in mind there also.
So if I could, bringing this back to the 180, if I've got storm scope information, and I got to say about, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, I was with a client in the ultimate bonanza, what an incredible airplane. It was that week where there were thunderstorms up and down the East Coast, and we were flying up and down the East Coast. And we had NEXRAD. We didn't have live radar. We had NEXRAD. We had XM, ADS-B, XM, and a storm scope. And it was the storm scope that we made our decisions on.
The big negative on the storm scope is the ranging areas, errors that are built in terms of where that strike actually is in terms of range from the airplane. They're pretty accurate in terms of the bearing from the aircraft, but depending on the actual individual strike and its strength, the storm scope can deceive you as to where it is in terms of distance from the airplane. The ADS-B and the data link are a little bit better in terms of geo-referencing the strike.
I understand that, but I'm also concerned with latency issues as well, okay? I like to think of all the data link stuff as strategic tools, but I like to think of storm scope as a tactical tool.
Maybe to Bob's defense on this too, the being able to flip-flop between the two is a technique that is probably undertaught, right? You know, these images from the MFD, you can see the displacement between where the strikes are and where the cell is. That's, you know, a red flag right there. You mix that with, oh, wait a minute, what's the latency on that NEXRAD? Okay, that's probably the same storm, and you've got to start doing this, you know, putting things together for yourself.
Mentally meshing them together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The data link at least gives you a good, you know, geo-reference on where the strikes are. And, you know, I remember the days when it used to be data link lightning was on like a 4-kilometer grid, and it was so old, and it was only cloud to ground. That, it, you know, if you didn't see it by then, you know, by the time that those strikes were there, it was already this big red blob. But now even the data link picks up cloud-to-cloud lightning. It's on a tighter grid, and it may be, you know, on a shorter delay. So you may be able to, like, sort of play one off against the other to get the big picture.
Yeah, there's also the possibility of dangerous convective weather that just hasn't produced lightning strikes yet. So, I mean, using both in combination, obviously.
Right, you're going to get that convection generally before you get the lightning strikes.
And before you get the precipitation that's right. Going to show up on any of that. You know, listening to all this too, it really, really emphasizes that point that we keep talking about all the time is knowing your system, knowing your product, knowing the differences and the nuances between these things. If you try to develop a strategy for storm avoidance using one product and you're applying the techniques from a different product, it's useless, you know, or it can be worse than useless. It can get you even further down. So it's incumbent to...
You could deceive yourself easily.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And there are so many different variations on this, on the different products and the nuances.
You know, one thing I want to go back to, John, you had talked about the difference between center radar and warp, which is essentially a NEXRAD image with a different secret sauce underneath it, and approach radar. Isn't there an approach fairly close below this pilot, but he's still talking to center? I mean, is that another a possibility for getting more information as to, you know, what's actually available at that moment? I think it's
Kansas. Let me see here. Looking it up quickly. It's Whitman approach.
Yeah. It's not that far away.
Right. So if they're above 10,000, more than likely you're talking to center. I don't know the exact airspace out there, but you might be talking to center. the chances of Center calling Tracon and saying, you know, what more than likely would happen would be as soon as you said you want to divert to Clinton, mm-hmm. Center's going to make an amendment. They're going to flash it at Whitman. Whitman's going to look at it and say, put this guy on such and such a heading based upon what they're seeing. Something like that, you know, don't send him direct because that's going to put him right in what I'm seeing. Put him on a, you know, some heading, something like that. So there might be some coordination there, but that's not really something you can really count on in that situation.
It would very much depend on the individual controllers, I think, that were working at that time. You could have an approach controller that would assume that Center's going to put the airplane in a good spot for the weather, not giving really much thought to the fact that Center's looking at a different set of weather data than the approach control has.
The communications with Center or approach, that brings up another issue here. I wouldn't be too confident that you're going to maintain communications in this situation here. So once that airplane gets charged up with static electricity, it's very possible you may intermittently lose your ability to communicate.
Which I wouldn't be worried about at that point.
No, it's yeah. Something, you know, this is comes under the classification of fly the airplane now.
Right. And I wouldn't be concerned about an altitude deviation or anything here either. You know, some people might say request a block or something like that. But at this point, the chances of having somebody 1,000 feet above me or below me is pretty much – and if not, they're going up and down the same way.
Yeah. You know, so you know, actually, you could go with a 7,700 squawk in a situation
if
like
you had
this.
To.
A mid-air collision in a thunderstorm is a pretty bad day.
Yeah. Yeah. and at that point, it's your day. Like, you know, there's really like – today is your time. It really is your turn. So, you know, putting that all together, it makes sense. I think, you know, looking on the split decision, the two things that this pilot has to deal with here, right, a lot of it comes down to really understanding the resources that are available to you, which means, you know, knowing your gear and being prepared to use it. You got to know what your autopilot's going to do and what it's capable of and what you're comfortable doing. And you got to use this big picture that even though we have all these resources like NexRed and StormScope and talking to the approach controller, it's still up to you in the cockpit to kind of layer all those together to get some kind of real-time image that is going to inform your decisions and let you make the right decisions so that you get to live to fly another day.